November Ethics Forum. This forum is always set up to allow us to hear from people within our community or to discuss issues that are pertinent to our immediate care of patients. And as you saw in the announcement that I sent out, Rabbi Weiner is going to be giving a brief presentation. Is it next week? The week after?
Next Friday.
Yeah, it's next Friday. I was looking at November, and it's like, that doesn't have the right dates there. Yeah, so next Friday at a conference, and he wanted the opportunity to go through some of the things that he's been working on just as a test run to make sure that he's on the right track in his thinking and to welcome some feedback from us. And I said, sure, we're always happy to oblige that. So I'm going to just turn it over to Jason and let him do his thing.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Stuart. It's really an honor. And I really, as Stuart was saying, my goal here is to share, of course, some interesting ideas, but mostly to get your feedback. So I'm going to be brief. I'm going to keep this under 25 minutes or so, and then really be interested in hearing what you think about it, pushback, questions, comments, your own ideas. I really want to hear. And I'm going to share my screen, though. I might go between sharing and, not, and unsharing, though. We'll see. So here's the topic. We're really focusing on CRISPR and is the CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing. And is this a case of playing God with our genes? Some theological reflections. And this first slide actually is not a slide that I'm going to be giving in that conference because everyone's familiar with it there. But I just want to make sure we're all on the same page first. So I just want to start off with just some basic background. And the basic idea is that CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing is a technology of actually genetic editing, not gene engineering. It's actually editing technology that can change an organism's DNA, either adding new DNA, removing old DNA, altering genetic material, or particular locations in the genome. It can be radically transforming the human DNA. And what's fascinating is that this technology was discovered by scientists based on an actually natural genome editing process that happens in nature in some forms of bacteria as an immune defense. And what it does is it captures small pieces of a virus's DNA when it's attacked by a virus and then inserts into them its own DNA to learn how to recognize that DNA. And then when that virus attacks again, it's able to cut apart and disable the virus. So it actually occurs in nature. What was unique was that researchers were able to figure out how to harness that technology and then use it to actually edit humans' DNA. There's an important distinction, which is between somatic and germline. So somatic refers to an adult, right? That's adult genetic editing, and that's very limited. We're going to talk about that a little bit. But it's much more limited to what can be done to an adult's DNA. And it's much less controversial. The big controversy has to do with germline gene editing. That's editing a sperm or egg or early embryo cells to totally transform that individual, and actually it becomes inheritable. So that becomes part of that all future generations of that individual, and this could completely alter humankind, which is why it's much more controversial. And if you're thinking like, well, come on. I mean, why are we worrying about this? This is futuristic. This is not happening anytime soon. So one of the researchers that really got the most fame for this and actually won a Nobel Prize in 2020 was Jennifer Doudna. And Jennifer Doudna published that first article on the topic in 2012 when she identified this process and how to harness that process. She did it in 2012. There was about 300 articles written in 2012. Every year, it doubled. By 2017, there were 5,000 articles a year, academic articles, scientific research articles being published on CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing. And in 2018, the first babies were born that had their genes edited. They were CRISPRified, as I call it. I don't know the technical term. There's probably a better term, but I'm going to stick with CRISPRified. Three babies were born. What had happened was, just to give you the background on that case, was that there was an independent lab. It was not part of a government or a university, independent lab in China where they realized, you know, one thing Jennifer Doudna talks about in her research is that how easy this is to actually do when a person knows what they're doing. And there was one researcher who wanted to figure it out and do it and become famous. And so he actually found some people in China who had HIV. And there was a lot of social stigma related to HIV. And they were worried about having children because their children, you know, could have HIV. And so this researcher put out a call for anyone who would like to genetically engineer their kids to be immune to HIV. And he actually got 300 people responding. And he did it on three of them. One of them it didn't take. But on two of them, he was actually able to edit their DNA and remove the receptors within our DNA that enable us to get HIV such that these children could never get HIV. Of course, he did this totally on his own. He hired a publicist, got the word out, and then was put in jail. He's in jail right now, and those kids are, you know, 3-4-year-old kids now, and no one's really following them either to even find out how the science worked. But that my point is that in 2012, this is first published, and already 6 years later, there's already children being born who have had their genes edited. And there's a lot happening with the somatic CRISPR already, but this is moving very quickly, and yeah, it might be we're talking a little bit futuristically, but this is not far in the future. It's coming quickly. And since it uses RNA technology, the mRNA vaccines also help to speed up the social acceptance and the process of utilizing CRISPR, even though obviously the recent, you know, Pfizer and Moderna vaccines were not gene editing. That was not, but it used a similar vehicle through the mRNA. And that, my point is just that helped to speed up the process. So now let's start talking about some of the concerns and ideas and challenges and possibilities that are inherent with this. So number one of the most common concerns, and in the literature, in a survey of 160 articles that detailed ethical concerns, the most common was off-target consequences. Off-target is another way of saying unintended consequences. The point being that we still don't know every precise role of each of our genes, nor what will happen if they're edited. And our genome is very complex and mysterious, and there are many things that are connected. As an example, so I mentioned somatic germline editing. So somatic in adults, one of the areas that's happening most frequently right now is with sickle cell anemia. Sickle cell anemia is a blood disease that is genetic, and they've figured out how to edit it out of one's genes. The way this works, just quick side point, for an adult is that it's kind of like dialysis. They go to a machine that takes their blood out, it edits it, and then puts it back in. And they can make some you know, minor changes. What they found out was that when you make someone immune to sickle cell anemia, you also they've lost those genes, that part of their DNA, they now are no longer have the immunity to malaria. It turns out there's a connection between sickle cell disease and malaria. And they found out that once we overcame sickle cell anemia, then all of a sudden malaria is more of a danger for those people. Like, we didn't realize those genes are connected. Or maybe someone would say, you know, I want to be a genius. I want to be brilliant. So I want to edit my genes to become smarter, have a better memory. And that sounds like a great idea, right? I think everyone would agree. Maybe not. Because imagine if you could always think about only the traumas you've experienced in your life, the misery, the pain, the horrible things that have happened. And this is already identified. Actually, the rabbis talked about this 1,000 years ago already. In a book called Chovos HaLevavos, where they talk about how our memory is connected to traumas, and that there's a downside to having a perfect memory. And so, you know, it goes to mental health as well. You know, it could be that, let's say we isolate the genes for anxiety, we edit them out. Imagine that person just becomes totally lethargic. They no longer have anxiety, but they also don't care about anything. Like, there could be many ways that we start messing with our genes and we have unintended off-target consequences. Furthermore, there could be malicious individuals or states that could take advantage of this technology to pervert it, to harm other people, whether, you know, unleashing destructive mosquitoes or, you know, who knows what, or rogue doctors or biohackers who just use it in irresponsible ways. However, these are concerns, but one thing I want to point out and start focusing on is that these are not intrinsic concerns, meaning they don't make the technology evil, right? It's not immoral in and of itself. It just means we have to be concerned and we can address them, you know, with very careful experimentation, ethical research, strict guidelines and oversight. So these are concerns and they're big concerns, but they don't mean that we cannot move forward, that this technology can't happen. But there are many concerns. So also social justice, you know, as we figure this out, what's going to happen if we're so focused in our society today, rightly so, in my opinion, on equity and reducing social inequalities. But what if we start to have a situation where only the wealthy have access to very expensive interventions that can make them genetically superior? So then we just exacerbate inequalities in our society and permanently genetically encode them into humanity. It could be a disaster. It could literally create a subclass of enhanced elites and just totally undermine basic values of equal opportunity and all people being created equally. In addition to that, or similar to that, what if we just got to a situation where there became like social pressure where people felt like, you know, I don't want to edit my children. I don't want to do this. I'm scared about this. But just to basically keep up, what if all the other kids in school, you know, they have all, you know, enhanced their IQ and their memories and their athletic abilities. So it starts to become a slippery slope where there's even if it's inappropriate in our community, in any given community, what if other countries or other communities start doing it? Like, there becomes a point at which the competition might lead to a slippery slope, and then people are creating designer babies and eugenics, which has a horrible racist history, and it could be very scary. Of course, some respond to this by saying, look, all new technologies start out expensive and difficult to access, but they gradually become more accessible to all. There's a question about that with CRISPR, by the way, because there might not be, you know, generic CRISPR possibilities. You know, and not everyone has the know-how, and kind of like the public acceptance might not be there. So that might not be true. But in general, things start out expensive and then they become, you know, gradually accepted. But also, if we just say, you know what, you're right, this is too risky, so restrict it. But if we restrict it too much, then scientists will simply move elsewhere. They'll move to some islands or some countries that don't have the same restrictions, where only the very wealthy and connected will be able to take advantage of it, and that will make the inequalities even worse. So the answer can't simply be, don't do it. The cat's out of the bag, so to speak, and we have to figure out an appropriate way forward. And so perhaps we can argue that, you know, someone would argue that you know, maybe we would even say not improving our children's health and well-being, which could prevent suffering by not editing their genes, when we have the ability to do so, is itself unethical. And it's sort of like having children, it could come to the point where having children without editing their DNA is playing sexual roulette. That's the phrase that some people have used. Like, why take your chances when there's things we could do? You know, there's a great book called The Codebreaker, written by Walter Isaacson, about this Dr. Jennifer Doudna, who's credited with really inventing CRISPR in certain ways. And she says that after every talk she gives, she has people crying and begging to her, waiting to meet her and begging to her, you know, that they have children who have, or they themselves are carriers for genetic mutation, begging and saying, you have the technology that could save my family's lives and prevent suffering. Please help us. Why are you being so careful and cautious? Save lives. You have the possibility, they have the ability, so do it. And others would simply say, look, why is it so scary when we talk about it, editing our genes? We allow investing in other advantages for our children, you know, private tutors, you know, SAT coaches, sports coaches, private, you know, basketball coaches or whatever sport it is, you know. So why is it problematic to provide beneficial genes that others get naturally when we're okay with hiring tutors, you know, things like that? So, you know, especially when we're talking about diseases that have no other hope of a cure. So maybe there's going to be inequalities. Some have suggested, so simply just don't allow patents in gene editing. And maybe that will keep it affordable and available for all. That's been, you know, one suggestion. On the other hand, there's another way of dealing with this, which some have said, look, we have to have some limits. There has to be some limitations. Can we really just make this a free-for-all? I mean, the possibilities and the off-target effects that I spoke about are too risky. So many, many have suggested, I was in rabbinic literature when it related to PGD, and this is in the ethics literature. Maybe we should distinguish between, you know, medical therapy treatments that fix dangerous genetic abnormalities, which is certainly could be justifiable, versus enhancements. Enhancements were that are we're trying to improve human capacities or traits, you know, totally change a person, totally change humanity. You know, let's say a military wants to create people that have infrared vision and night vision and x-ray vision and bulletproof skin and things like that. You know, at a certain point that becomes problematic. That's really designer babies. The problem is, though, with this distinction, which is this is a very common distinction, therapy versus enhancement. That seems to a lot of people say, oh, that's all you got to distinguish between, and then you're safe ethically, morally. But there's a lot of gray area there. I mean, what if someone is, you know, very below average height or IQ, and they simply argue, look, just to be able to survive in society, I just want to be able to edit my family's genes to be average. And it will just help us, and it can even help our health, you know, to just to have some basic obstacles removed for us. So we're not trying to become superhuman. We're just trying to be able to kind of be like everyone else. We just want an opportunity to be normal. Let's say someone made that argument. It's hard to say that, oh, that's just, you know, designer babies and enhancement. That you could make the argument that that's a sort of therapy. It's certainly a quality of life concern. And the truth is that I believe that, you know, the rabbis also will accept that. We believe in the importance of quality of life, enhancing quality of life. Some have said, you know, we have to limit it even more, only prevention, but not actually making changes. In my opinion, see, I believe that it is possible to say, you know what, I believe in this distinction between therapy and enhancements, and I want to only allow medical therapy, but we can be pretty broad in what's considered medical therapy. And those enhancements that could enable someone to live a healthier life, that could be justifiable. And the way I would word this is the way one of the great rabbis of the last generation suggested. His name was Rav Eliashiv. And he suggested the red line should be super enhancements. At the point at which you're developing new capabilities which humans never possessed before. Like I mentioned, you know, it could be like seeing new colors on the spectrum, or hearing super high frequencies, or preventing aging, or extreme heights, or things like that. Developing capabilities that humans never had before, that's like superhuman, that to me is a red line. And not just to me, that to many thinkers, that's really a red line, and that's how we should be thinking, in my opinion. Like, we can be justifiable within broadening the definition of what's a medical therapy, but there has to be certain limits. But now I really want to get into the area that I want to focus on. This is just an important background, but Stuart asked me, and I wanted to talk about playing God. So, whoa, this is getting divine here. So when we talk about playing God, I hope you like that. That's about all I can do with PowerPoint. That's as far as my skills go. So anyways, in a study that I mentioned before of 160 articles opposing gene editing, 13 of them identified the primary concern as playing God. Playing God is, and this is what I really want to, you know, focus my remaining few minutes on as a rabbi. You know, this is my focus. The concern becomes, like I just mentioned, we can edit our genes for medical therapies and things like that. But at what point is it still inappropriate? Should we really be playing around with our genome? I mentioned the off-target effects as we opened up. We don't know what's going to happen to our genome. And God created us in a certain way. Like, should we really think that we are God? Now, many in the scientific community, if this is my argument, you know, we shouldn't play God, many people don't identify with theological concerns. But I really believe that the scientific community can't afford to ignore this concern, because it's a major concern. And of course, government funding is relevant. And, you know, this technology impacts entire society, right? So it's essential for widely held and well-informed public approval to legitimize it. And we've seen in the past some new interventions, like embryonic stem cell research, that many religious communities did not accept, and they saw as a form of abortion or whatever it was. They had intrinsic moral concerns, and that did slow down the progress. And I want to argue that if CRISPR has the opportunity, the potential to radically transform humanity and reduce suffering and help the world, we have to be very careful about how we move forward to bring on board as many as possible. And if we want to bring on board those in religious community, we should take seriously concerns about playing God. And the truth is, it's often articulated in secular ways. So you'll see in the literature, when many talk about, you know, concerns about playing God, they'll write things like, you know, they won't say, don't play God. They'll say, This is a risky deviation from the natural reproductive process. Or the evolutionary process is beyond human capacity to fully understand, making it likely that interference with our genes will result in negative outcomes. Or they'll say things like, manipulating the mysterious and delicately interwoven forces of nature could undermine crucial traits of empathy, humility, striving for excellence, and appreciation for diversity. So my point is simply that playing God is not just a religious concern. Many people worry about playing God, even if they don't use those terms of playing God. And now I'm speaking from a Jewish perspective. And the truth is, from a Jewish perspective, playing God is actually not a concern. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. And playing God is a good thing because there's the idea is we want to fight illness. We don't just accept imperfection in the world, but we interfere with nature to fight illness and improve the world. We were put on this planet to partner with God as co-creators, and therefore playing God is not, like, that doesn't make me say, oh, CRISPR's playing God, therefore we have to stop. No, not only that, the Talmud has an incredible line where it says that God created Adam, this is a quote, with creative knowledge similar to divine knowledge. And on the first Saturday night, the first Sabbath, it was used to create fire and then made a horse and donkey to create a mule. And so we could say it's a blessing. The creativity and the ability to harness the powers of nature is a gift from God. That God gave us the skill, and that we should be thanking God that, look, we have unlocked the keys to humanity. We have now figured out what God put in. As I mentioned at the outset, this was all a natural process in bacteria, the way they fought viruses. And so God put that in there with evolution, with creation, however you want to say it. And now we've discovered how to harness it to make the world a better place. We didn't just do this as a rebellion against God. This is an opportunity to use our God-given powers as long as we're not using them to do something that's prohibited or leads to a prohibited act or as long as its benefits outweigh the risks. So the way I would word this, and I'm curious to hear your feedback on this. This is a line I sort of came up with, which is that, and listen carefully. The issue is not playing God, but playing God. I'll say that again. The issue is not playing God, but playing God. It's all about the emphasis. And that's why I put it here, in italics. It's being God-like is good, but not taking that seriously is what's a problem. And playing around with those capabilities, that's a concern. But playing God, meaning being a partner with God in accordance with, basic ethical structures to help the world become a better place, that I think is a good thing. So how far do we go? So within the scientific world, there's bioliberals and biotech utopianists. And on the other hand, there's bioconservatives and techno-skepticists. Those are some of the words that they use. And they debate something called the precautionary principle versus the innovation principle. And the basic idea is that the precautionary principle, which was initially articulated in 1992 at a UN conference on environmental development regarding genetically modified agriculture, which, by the way, all this CRISPR gene engineering, this is happening in the agriculture world. I think you probably know, with animals and with plants. But one of the community's feelings was we have to have a sense of precaution. Now, the innovation principle is like what I said before. There are those who just say, like, if you can save lives, if you can do things, why not rush to do it? The precautionary principle, on the other hand, is trying to be more cautious. One way I've been thinking about it to myself a lot lately, as I've been thinking about this, I've been basically obsessed with this topic for the past 6 weeks or so. And one kind of rabbit hole I went down was I realized this is also related to the FDA approval process. And there's a whole movement, as you might be aware, of the right to try movement, about accelerating new drugs. That once you have a treatment for, let's say, it often comes up with cancer therapies, that once the technology exists, we should be accelerating them to save more lives. But there is another side of the coin where many argue that, you first need very robust data collection. You have to ensure safety, efficacy, and that way you help the most people. Because when you accelerate the approval, it can actually expose some patients to unsafe or ineffective drugs, and that can distract from other potentially better trials
and it diverts attention from these alternatives. And also, when you accelerate approval, it could delay generating data because people say, why should I be in a trial? Let me just get the drug and save my life. But then you don't have the data, and then you don't have as large of trials. Or other alternative innovations oftentimes will say, oh, you know what? Someone else was already approved. Let's focus our energies on creating a different drug and not invest in these treatments. And then if it turns out 3 years later that that first drug that was accelerated doesn't turn out to be effective, well, there's no one kind of on deck because it was rushed to approval. So it could be that sometimes the precautionary principle can save more lives, even though while we're waiting, there are those who will not get treated, unfortunately. And so the precautionary principle, the basic idea is that, on the one hand, we have the bioethical principle of non-maleficence, first do no harm, while recognizing that research should move forward eventually. So on the other hand, there's the principle of beneficence, love your neighbor as yourself, which is ultimately permanent. But the point is that this is sort of a yellow light approach. It's not saying no. My goal here is not to say no, and I'm going to get back to playing God in a second, but to just have a yellow light, meaning the burden of proof should be on the side of safety and efficacy first, to thoroughly demonstrate that safety and that this is a good thing by those who are advocating for the new therapy before we move forward. And this is especially so when it comes to gene editing, CRISPR. Why? Because on the one hand, science has already demonstrated that the human genome is much more complex than we previously thought. That, as I mentioned with the example of sickle cell anemia and anxiety and memory before, as just a couple examples, there's many, many more. And also, when our capabilities proceed faster than our knowledge about these outcomes, we really have to say, we can say yes, but not yet. Yes, but not yet. And this is what happened with IVF, for example. It was privately funded only for initially, and then eventually the government realized that this was effective, and then they got on board. And so what we look for is a prudent path forward. That was meant to be a checkers board. That's why I chose that, because, prudent path forward, playing checkers, chess, I don't know. I'm just having too much fun with this, I guess. But the goal should be to carefully ensure that, number one, all safety issues are carefully clinically tested. Number two, ethical issues are resolved as well as possible. Number three, that there's a social consensus formed over if this is the right way to evolve. And that's essential, because these consequential issues have to be settled by society as a whole. This cannot be an ivory tower issue. It affects the world too much. Not individuals or just the scientific community alone. It has to be the whole society. There needs to be a public debate and scrutiny, because that process will help to educate broader society and probably improve public confidence. And I think it's especially important, essential, to include religious communities in the conversation, because as I said before, I don't believe that CRISPR is intrinsically immoral, and therefore there's an opportunity for buy-in. And as long as we can maintain our humility with these new capabilities, I want to share with you now, I think, one of the most important ways of framing this, and then I want to suggest something as I begin to conclude. And there was another book that I read in the last couple of months called The Precipice. The Precipice by Toby Ord, a professor at Oxford. This is a fascinating read, absolutely fascinating. It's called Existential Risk and the Future of Humanity, where he goes over the four, what in his opinion are the four greatest risks to human survival in the future. And he says that's basically, the concerns are basically nuclear war, artificial intelligence, which he says is the biggest risk. That's for another time. Pandemics, and he published this right before COVID, by the way, and climate change. And anyways, in that, he talks about something that is just fascinating. And he gives a really important, I want to say the Hebrew word, mashal, an allegory, an example. And this, I've been thinking about this constantly, and I'll tell you right now. He says, okay, imagine the world. This is in his writing. He says, human civilization is something like 5 to 10,000 years old. Let's go with 5,000 years old of human civilization as we know it. He says, most species can live for 1 billion years. So now let's think about it. If humans are 5,000 years old, but we can live for a billion years, let's even say hundreds of millions. So where are we on our lifespan? In our lifespan as humans, at 5,000 years old, but the potential to go hundreds of millions. So in other words, we are adolescents. We are currently adolescents. Adolescence is the age when children develop the physical abilities and the appetite for risk, but they don't yet have the wisdom, self-control, or long-term perspective and maturity to actually behave properly. You know, an adolescent can do all kinds of damage, right? An adolescent could get pregnant. An adolescent could, you know, shoot up a school, God forbid. Adolescent could drive a car and get into a horrible accident. So they're starting to have the physical capability of doing all kinds of things, but they don't yet have the maturity. So what do? Well, we design societies to protect the kids, right? So we have laws. You can't drive yet when you're 12 years old. You know, we have parents and we have police, and we're trying to protect society and protect children, adolescents, because we know that even though they might disagree with us, we know that they're not yet mature enough to use all of their physical capabilities. So Toby Ord's question then is, if that is where we are today, we are now adolescents, humanity is now at the adolescent phase of our evolution, of our development. So part of the question is, who is our adult? Where's the adult in the room, so to speak, for humanity? How do we control ourselves? He suggests, for example, you know, he says we should come up with rules like no advancement in nuclear technology until humanity has gone 100 years without a war, is an example he gives. Okay, we're failing at that. But still, is it, you know, the government, bioethicists, clergy? There has to be someone thinking about this. And part of my concern is, even with CRISPR, we can enhance our intelligence. That could be possible. We can enhance memory and speed of thinking and IQ. But enhanced intelligence does not equal enhanced wisdom. And this leads me to where I really want to start to conclude. This is my concluding remarks in the last two slides. So the biggest kind of off-target concerns, in my opinion, is actually, you know, what if we could actually perfect the human body, right? What if we did perfect the human body and such that it doesn't age or slow down? Would that be a good thing? Are we doing the right thing? Is this actually the wise thing to do? And, you know, if we did, for example, just some things I'm thinking about. If we could not age anymore, slow down aging, what incentives would there be for the old to make way for the young? That's important with human progress. And now I'm talking like a bioconservative about being careful, let's use precaution. But this might also be a progressive point that I'm trying to make here, which is that if the young aren't given a chance to lead, this might lead to a prolongation of functional immaturity because they don't have incentives to try to lead because they know that the older generation is not going to make way for them because they're not going anywhere. So if the young have no incentive to lead and the old have no desire to pass the baton to a new generation, what happens to the motivation for human progress, social advancement, and innovation? There is a need, first of all, the desire to want to become a leader forces people to innovate and lead. Also, just the very fact of when new leaders take over, you know, the new generation, they think in different ways. That is basic part of human progress. I already see teenagers today think differently than me. And you know, maybe they're not ready yet, but there's going to come a point in time where I can't speak to the next generation. Like we become out of touch, and we need the next generation to become the leaders. That's human progress. Human progress is passing the baton. And if we're moving in a direction of not passing that baton, is this really progressive? We're going to be healthier, but maybe the world needs a new generation every generation. Maybe that's a good thing. And so what I want to argue is that true wisdom, when we talk about wisdom, not intelligence, but wisdom, is just because something can be done doesn't mean it always should be done. And my example for that is the Talmud tells an amazing story about King Hezekiah. There was a king named Hezekiah. I guess in English it's Hezekiah. And he had a book called the Sefer Refuot. There was a book that existed in ancient Israel, apparently, called the Book of Healing. Actually, it was full of all the herbs, the different herbs that could be used for different illnesses. And one of the herbs they used most frequently actually was the cedar tree, just by the way, for Cedars of Sinai. But at one point he realized people lost humility because they were so invested in this book and they stopped relying on God. And so Hezekiah actually banished that book and was able to remove it, that no one had access to it anymore. And he said, even though there will be more illness, and as I said, Judaism is very pro fighting illness, but he said, we've gone too far, we need to banish this book. And so he did. And this leads me to my concluding point. And then I really want to hear your feedback and your pushback and your comments. And this gets to just a little bit of a story. A couple of years ago, we lost the great Rabbi Lord Dr. Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. And Rabbi Sacks, when he died, there was a book that he had just finished writing, and it wasn't even available yet. And the very last pages of the last book before he died, there was a very poignant statement there that I always think about, and I realize it's relevant for this conversation as well. He asked the question, it's a book about the Torah, so he asked the question, why does the Torah, the Bible, end with Moses not getting to the promised land? It seems so unfair. We've been following the journey the whole way, and then the book ends with not a happy ending. Moses is denied entry to the promised land, and it seems so sad. Why didn't he get in? And Rabbi Sacks makes the argument that this is to teach us three great life-changing ideas with which the Torah ends. Number one, we are mortal, and therefore we have to make every day count. Number two, we are fallible, and therefore we have to learn to grow from each mistake. And number three, we will not complete the journey, and therefore we have to inspire others to continue what we began. And my concern is that if we get too caught up with this technology, like I said, I want to be clear. I believe that CRISPR gene editing, when proven safe and effective and moving forward slowly, I think it's a good thing. I think this is messianic. I think this has an opportunity to wipe out illness and human suffering in ways we've never imagined before. I think it's a great thing. But I think there's a lot to think about. And the religious community can help to bring that discussion about moral, ethical, wisdom-related concerns. And these are a different type of off-target effects. You're not going to figure this out in the lab, but this is a real issue. And I think we need to think about this before we move forward too quickly with editing our genes. But we also need, and now talking to the religious community, we need to be ready to move forward quickly and have these conversations right away, because it's moving. And if we're not ready to have the conversation, it will happen without us. So those are my comments, and now I really, really want to hear what you have to say about all of this.
Thanks, Jason. And so everybody, remember that you are muted. So if you want to participate in asking a question, you have to unmute yourself, and then please remute yourself so that we don't get anything back. Or you could always put something in the chat. For instance, Jonathan Schreiber wrote that heart bypass surgery looks like playing God if we go with the sort of initial arguments that you were presenting, and most people wouldn't say, oh, we should never do.
Exactly. And people there might have been a day when people were saying like, oh, wow, people, you mean you're going to cut a person open to try to cure them? Like, that's crazy. And now we say like surgery is a basic normal part of medicine, and it's a great thing. So a lot of this, you know, it's contextual, but yes, I totally agree with you, Jonathan. Yeah, people would say surgery and all these types of interventions were playing God, and now we see this as basic healthcare.
Hi, this is Jeff Pomerantz. Jason, it was really a nice presentation. I enjoyed it and learned stuff in it. There's a technical point of arithmetic here. You said we're 5,000 years old, and maybe we're taking the lower end of your estimate that we'll go for 200 million years, and we're in adolescence. 5,000 is way, way, way less than 1%.
Yeah.
So you need to choose a different...
Well, so this is Toby Ord's analogy, but I think his point is that it's not numerically, like mathematically. He just feels that we've gotten to that point where we're like adolescents. So I agree. If humanity's...
I'm not disagreeing with your point. I'm just disagreeing with your arithmetic.
Yeah, I'll have to say it better in the future, because that's the way he says it. But his point is, you're right, because we'd still be like, you know, two-year-olds or whatever, if that's the... Or less.
We would be more like fetuses.
Yeah, fetuses still. Right, exactly.
Ahead, so.
I agree with a lot of what Jason said. The only thing I would kind of be careful how you use the sickle cell example, because sickle cell disease consists of a gene from the mother and the father.
Yeah.
And those children are very, very sick, and they die from malaria. The parents are the ones who are somewhat protected by the gene, because one gene protects you, the double gene
right.
makes you very, very sick. So you can use it, but I would be careful to emphasize that those children actually die from malaria.
And yeah, thank you.
It's important to, but otherwise, I very much agree with what you're saying, especially it should be used for medical things and not really for enhancement, but mm-hmm. I don't know how you stop the train once it's going.
That's a big challenge.
So Jason, in yes. that regard, couple things that stood out. One is, is there any Jewish literature about drawing lines in terms of therapy or enhancement?
Yes. So the Jewish literature on this came out regarding PGD, preimplantation genetic diagnosis. When that was new, the rabbinic authorities at that time said that PGD can be justified by Jewish law when it's for a medical need, not for an enhancement need. Like if someone would want to just have a child with a certain color hair or something like that, that would not be justifiable reason to use PGD. So I was applying that discussion from PGD to gene editing.
So it might be helpful when you're on slides 7 and 8 mm-hmm. or the transition from 7 to 8 to be able to give people some idea of what that literature is
okay.
and even the basis, just to say that there was this discussion and actually it draws its basis from.
Okay.
Just so people have an idea that it's not completely brand new.
Right.
There's a history here. The other thing, and I'm wondering because of what Carol just raised, if there is any place for you to note that, at least in the popular imagination, and even though you'll be talking with people who are scientists and researchers, in the popular imagination, there is this idea of a one-to-one correspondence. One gene, one effect.
Right.
And part of what you show in the very simple thing about the examples with malaria and sickle cell is that is a overly simplistic understanding. And so that if you make it explicit that one of the challenges for those people who are in leadership in gene editing is to educate the community, because most people hear one gene, one effect. And that's already then part of what drives some of the concerns. Because it's like, oh, if you change one gene, you will change only this one thing. That's good. And that's a misunderstanding.
Right.
Or the other way of looking at it is people will be as if you start changing one gene, you change everything and we control everything, which also doesn't make sense because we actually, your point is that we change one gene, and part of the issue is we don't all know what the ramifications of that are. That's why we need to have this careful deliberation.
Good. Yes, I'll make them more explicit. I appreciate that. Good point. Any other pushback, feedback, critique, questions?
I have lots, but I'm going to let other people go.
There are some questions in the chat that you might want to look at.
Oh, there are more chat stuff? Okay.
Right, that's interesting. Someone wrote, does not the phrase playing God imply we have some idea of how God plays? And that's part, I think that's part of the very essence of the concern when those say we shouldn't play, who say we shouldn't play God is we are not God, and therefore we can't play God because we don't know how God plays, so to speak. So yeah, I think that is a great point. Carrie asked, thinking about...
Jason, but it's a good point, but you need to incorporate it, because this is why I had a similar point of mind, which is on your slide 9, and I know that by the time you get to slide 11, you're doing this issue of what it means to play God, but you might need to say, like at slide 9, something about what playing God even means. What do people think that means? Because part of the concerns is couched in how people think playing God functions in our conceptions.
Uh-huh.
And that's what that point was, is that some people will see that as that means that we know what God does. Who are we to know that? So I think you might need to just say something about the problem of what it even means to play God.
Uh-huh.
And say that up front as part of the problem.
I like that. Thank you. Yeah, Carrie, you ask an interesting question about, you know, how do we engage in safety in germline editing, experimentation, safe clinical trials. I think the two things that I would say about that is, number one, that they move very, very slowly, and that we start off, you know, I mentioned like prevention only, medical versus enhancement, super enhancements. Like, there should be a lot of those restrictions at the very beginning, that were focused specifically on very significant illnesses only, and moving slowly, and then it can gradually gain acceptance and work out. But not being a, you know, a scientific researcher myself, I can't give much more specific than that. But that's my initial thoughts about it. I'd say it's a really good point, Dr. Geideman, or Stuart, were you going to say something?
I was going to say, so can you give examples towards the end when you're talking about the idea of slowing things down, trying to demonstrate some sort of wisdom about this? Can you give examples? Obviously, as rabbi, you're going to draw from the Jewish tradition, but you might be able to draw from other religious traditions where there's examples where the religious authorities said, not so fast. And 50, 100 years later, 20 years later, whatever it is, said, now that we have the evidence, okay.
Yeah. The truth is, I mentioned it very briefly, but IVF, I think, is actually a good example of that. That there were rabbis who in the 80s said that IVF should be totally forbidden by Jewish law. And the very same rabbis, less than 20 years later, said it should be strongly encouraged. And that happened in the secular world as well, where the government, there wasn't federal funding at first, but then once it was proven safely in private labs, people were brought on board. So I think that could be an example of where it was used very slowly and carefully, and then when it was shown to be effective, got buy-in.
And maybe even vaccines.
That's a good one too. You're right.
Something that's even more normalized now.
You're right. And I'm going to be giving this lecture in Harvey Morris, and I want to be able to point to a few people on the wall there, and I can use Dr. Jesse Lazar, who's on the wall there.
Go ahead, Carol.
Yeah, it should... Am I muted?
No, we hear you.
Yeah, it should be noted that actually they are going very slowly with it because of dangers. And some of the first attempts at manipulating the genes, there was one time when the boy developed leukemia.
Yeah.
So the whole project was closed down for a long time. And the other thing to notice, especially when you're talking about viruses and vaccines, that human evolution is probably due to viruses, that the viruses themselves have gone in. Because in order to do all this, they use viruses to modify the genes. They put viral vectors in, and that's how they change the genes with a viral vector. But viruses themselves have caused human evolution. Not all of it, but a lot of it.
That's interesting.
So it's the viruses that have led to the leukemia, but also the viruses is how they do it. You know, they put these viral vectors in. But it's being done too now, like with hemophilia. That's another disease. There's just a report in this week's New England Journal of a successful trial of hemophilia. So it can be very useful, but there are possible... You also have to go for a long time. Like, maybe the side effects won't show up in 2 years, but maybe in 10 years you'll see some sort of side effect. So.
Right, right, exactly. It can be very long term.
Things we don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Joel, you had your hand up before.
Yes, I did. Jason, after the lecture, I'll email you something. I just finished a novel I'm getting published on, and the background really has to do with aging. And there's a lot of scientific research currently being done on aging.
Yeah.
One of the most prominent people is at UCLA. And, you know, the manifestations, if we were able to stop aging, would ruin the planet. We'd be overcrowded. We wouldn't have enough food. There'd be wars over food and water.
Absolutely.
All kinds of other things. My point really is, first of all, I thought you'd get a great lecture, terrific lecture. But I wonder if there's a way that you should also, instead of just, in addition to focusing on CRISPR, whether there's broader of statements having to do with other methods and other science that are trying to achieve some goals that we think might be worthy, but might have very harmful effects on society.
Interesting. My challenge is that I only have 20 minutes. Now, I know it took me about 30 minutes today, and also I know that when someone gives a rabbi 20 minutes, it means 30 minutes. Well, at least that's what it means to me. So, but the challenge is that I have a limited amount of time, but I want to think about this for other, you know, scenarios, so I do appreciate that. And I'd love to see what you're going to send me, Dr. Geideman.
Yeah. Did you see in the chat there, Nate?
Yeah, Jason? It's an interesting question. How do we encourage the younger generation from better understanding the benefits and risks of gene science technology, especially when there is so much suspicion with science already? It's a good question. I mean, I thought Dr. Finder made a good point earlier about the importance of proper education and finding, you know, we do need it. You're right. We need to find ways to educate the next generation. It's really important. We can't just say we're passing the baton and not prepare, help to prepare those to whom we're passing the baton to. It's an important consideration.
So this might, again, yes, you only have 20 minutes and you need to do everything.
Yeah.
To talk about how, if there's any way to give an example or two, probably just one, of where religion, in the face of what appears to be a threat from science as a taking over control of the way people think, mm-hmm. where religious movements have been willing to work with the scientific community or not to stand in the way of, as opposed to what, again, many people think of as science versus religion, and they see it as conflict. And if you can give some example of where the religious community and the scientific communities can actually work together to help in terms of this education and to allay some suspicion by raising up education.
That's very good. I'll think about that. Anything else?
Go ahead, Carol.
I think all those points are very well taken, and I agree with Joel. I mean, when you think about it, if you really could prevent aging, you will ruin, that will be the end of humanity, because you won't be able to have more children, there won't be new people, it'll just be plugging up everything. So,
you know, the worst thing actually, Carol, is that people would reproductive forever. So among other things, that's one of the problems, is that, you know, currently you sort of age out of being able to have children. But we keep adding people who can have children without ever stopping the ability.
Oh, it would be awful. The other thing is that just from a completely non-denominational or anything or apolitical point of view, it just seems that at the moment, religion is not popular with, I don't know, the powers that be or whatever. So, Jason, what are you going to do about that?
Yeah, I don't know that I have the solution. In many ways, though, it does feel that the, you know, kind of the secular world and the religious world are moving away from each other further and further. But I think that that's a sad thing. So my goal is to try to keep them in conversation, at least myself, you know, like to, as much as I can. I can't control the whole world, but it's important to continue having this conversation. That was really one of my points, I think. And because I think that CRISPR can be embraced to certain extents by religious individuals. So I think there's an opportunity for working together here. This could be a great opportunity for actually moving forward with science together with, you know, the religious communities. And maybe it can be healing in some ways of those gaps, you know.
Anybody else have any other thoughts for Jason? He has
very good
a few days left to get this done.
It's very good. Very interesting.
Thank you. I think it's really important conversation, and I just appreciate your input and feedback, because we're going to have to be all facing this together. I mean, it's moving quickly, and it's reality. I think there is wisdom out there for us to help guide us. Much of it is possessed by Stuart Finder. So I look forward to Stuart's feedback is in particular. I'm joking. I'm giving you.
Oh, good.
And I'm glad Jonathan liked that.
I liked the joke.
Very good.
It wasn't a joke, but thank you all. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to share these ideas and to think about them with you. And any other feedback you might have, please feel free to reach out. I love to discuss it. I just find it so important and interesting.
So Jason?
Yeah.
Just, I don't know how much, do you want feedback on any of your slides? Like just the slides?
Yeah, I'm not that good at PowerPoint. And you're one of the best people at PowerPoint that I know, actually. And so if you have feedback on any of them, yes, please share them.
Okay.